expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
Hopefully that woke you up. Good morning and welcome to this March 13th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more details on that later in the hour. I'm your host, Marie Stone, doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. If you're into mysteries, thrillers, character studies, I have some thrills for you coming up this morning. I'm here now with Alex Michaelides talking about The Silent Patient, and coming up in the second half hour, Amy Meyerson will be here talking about her novel, The Bookshop of Yesterdays. Alex Michaelides was born in Cyprus in 1977 to a Greek father, an English mother. He studied English literature at Cambridge and got his MA in screenwriting at the American Film Institute in L.A. He wrote the film The Devil You Know in 2013, starring Rosamund Pike, and co-wrote The Brits Are Coming, starring Uma Thurman, Tom Roth, Parker Posey, Sofia Rivera. The Silent Patient is his first novel. It is going to drive much of our discussion this morning. Alex, welcome.
Hello. Hi. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you so much. So before we dive into the novel, I would love to hear about this journey from screenwriting to novelist and kind of how that came about, and maybe, you know, kind of what screenwriting may have given you and perhaps what you had to overcome.
Right. It was quite a journey, I suppose, in a way. I took a lot from screenwriting. I think most writers are, you know, strongly influenced by film these days, whether we want to admit it or not. I'm very into, you know, Hitchcock and Billy Wilder, and I studied screenwriting at the American Film Institute, as you just mentioned. So I suppose the big thing I always think about when writing is something Billy Wilder said, and he said that, you know, if you have a scene without a plot point in it, it's a bad scene. And so don't write it because you'll cut it. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's something that I really subscribe to. So that would be the most filmic element of the book, I suppose, is that I was conscious that every chapter have a plot point to keep it going, a bit like a train, you know. Also, the other thing I think about a lot was the difference, really. A friend of mine is a critic, and he once said something that really struck me, and he said that film writing, screenplays are about contraction, whereas novels are about expansion. And that's something I think that's what's made me into a novelist, or marked the fact that maybe I am a novelist rather than a screenwriter, because the moment I was able to get inside Alicia's head and spend time with her, you know, the expansion part, I think, is about exploring the minutiae of someone's life and really kind of, you know, going for a walk with them in the park, or, you know, spending the day with them. Whereas in a film, you wouldn't do that because you've got to contract it and you've got to keep moving. And I think the ability to kind of really slow down and luxuriate transformed me as a writer, actually.
Yeah, I can really see that. I appreciate you saying that, because I do think the power of the novel is getting inside a character's head, and you're not as reliant on dialogue. You're certainly much more prone to explore psychology and inner thoughts. And
yes,
once you have I was thinking about this movie for the screen, because, or not this movie, this book for the screen, because once you have a character who doesn't speak, it would be very challenging on the screen.
Yeah. That's true. This felt very much as like a last attempt for me. I don't know if we're going to get into that or not, but I was kind of reaching the end of the road with the writing, I felt. And I felt before I kind of give up, I'm going to try writing the novel, you know, the one novel I'd always wanted to write and somehow I'd never found time for. And so it was very important to me that I write it as a book, not as a movie. So I didn't really think about it at all in terms of how a film might be adapted from it. Which is why it's a funny situation to find myself in now.
Right, right. Is it, are they
about to?
I was going to say, are they do? I think you are adapting it to the screen, yeah. And you are the screenwriter.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Okay. That will be wonderful.
I am doing this. Yeah, I'm doing the screenplay for the movie, so it'll be a very weird, kind of strange experience taking it apart again and putting it together. But, you know, one of the things about, I think, trying and not succeeding terribly well for many years, it means that I have a much smaller ego than I used to. So I'm very happy to take the book apart and try and make it work in a different way without being precious. So I think it's very important as a writer not to hold on to things too tightly. I think for many years I harmed myself because I would fall in love with a piece of dialogue or the idea for a scene, whereas now I'm very happy to tear it up and start again.
Interesting. Well, let's dive into the novel so listeners who haven't yet picked it up know what we're talking about. And I'll kind of let you set the stage for it and kind of take us into this world, and we'll jump off from there.
Sure. Okay, well, the novel is called The Silent Patient, and it is about a famous painter, Alicia Berenson, who one day shoots her husband dead, and then she refuses to speak ever again. And it's narrated by Theo Faber, who is a psychotherapist who's working with her. He's trying to get Alicia to start speaking again, as well as sort of unravel the mystery of what happened the night she killed her husband and why she killed her husband.
And so you said that this was the novel that you had always wanted to write. And so I'm kind of curious about the point of entry for you. If it started with one of these characters, if it started with a situation, kind of what took you into it?
Well, it was a very clear point of entry for me. You know, I grew up in Cyprus, which is a very small island, and I grew up without the internet. And so all I had in the summer, which were very long and boring, were books. And I sort of fell in love with Agatha Christie when I was about 13, and I would be at the beach and just read obsessively Agatha Christie novels. And that was probably the happiest period of my life, if I'm honest with you. So when I set out to write a novel, it was very clear that I wanted to recreate that experience and write something in that mold, possibly with a kind of deeper psychological complexity that I could read on the beach. And I did that when I got the draft of Silent Patient to a decent place. I printed it out and I took it to Spain. And it was a really nice experience. I felt very happy. So it was about that. It was about creating a modern Agatha Christie and what she might write if she were alive now with my life experience, I suppose.
That's lovely. So let's talk a little bit about these characters, because they're both psychologically very complex in their own way. I understand from reading a little about you that therapy has played an important role in your life, not just on the page, but elsewhere. And so I'm curious about how that has inspired Theo's character. But talk a little bit about your process of getting to know these characters. Who may have given you the most trouble, mining them out? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I suppose I'll start with Theo, because there are two narrators. Alicia doesn't speak, or Alicia in English in England and Alicia in America. So forgive me if I alternate between two pronunciations. She doesn't speak, and so I came to the idea of giving her a voice through these diary entries. So there are two narrators, but, you know, ostensibly Theo is the narrator, and he's the one that's closer to me, I suppose. I was trying to write a detective story, essentially, you know, but I'm not a detective. And I had always felt that my writing had been a bit shallow, and I wanted to try and access some depth. And so I thought, okay, well, if he's going to be a kind of detective figure, what do I actually know about? And one of the things I did know about was psychotherapy. And I studied it at a couple of different places, and I worked in a secure unit for teenagers for a couple of years. And the moment I thought about that, I thought, oh, yes, I know about that. It's like, you know, the Christie-style iconic enclosed location. I thought, okay, a psychiatric unit and a psychotherapist, I can write that voice convincingly. And it kind of went from there, really. And he did become very alive to me. I think I put a lot of myself, my heart and soul, into him. But also, you know, it's funny because people say, oh, you're Theo, but I'm actually both equally. I'm also Alicia. She is a painter, you know, and I'm a writer. And so I just transposed all of my thoughts about writing, what it is to be a writer, into her. And it's really funny because on Instagram, a couple of people who are actually artists have said it's as if I've seen into their minds as painters. Whereas in fact, I wasn't speaking about painting; I was speaking about writing. and so I became her, and I walked around the park in Hampstead where I live for several I put off writing the diary entries until the very end because I felt that they were scary to me. I didn't know how to do it. And so when I did finally get to it, I spent about a month or two just recording myself, taking notes on my phone, walking around the park, sort of trying to get into her head, you know. And then they both came alive. I was really happy with that, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very interesting technique to walk around the park and dictate so that it's almost, you know, if you're not sitting at the blank computer screen staring at the cursor, but you're literally walking around and narrating it to get into her head. I'm going to incorporate that. I haven't tried that before. That's a great idea.
Well, it was fortuitous, really. I mean, it only came out of a state of panic, you know, because I was staring at the screen where I write in my kitchen and I thought, I can't do this. And so I sort of was, but she walks around. So, but it, you know, became part of the novel because she walks around the park
a lot
herself.
Right.
You know, so it all kind of worked out really well.
A bit of method acting, I guess it is.
Right? method writing.
Method writing. Right. Well, this is a perfect time. I would love for there's a passage in here. I don't normally have writers read, but there is a passage in here that is so perfectly tailored to the artistic process in both Alicia's, you know, visual painting and the writing process that I'd love for you to read it. Do you know where I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Okay,
I'm just confining the point here.
Okay.
I must apologize. As you can probably tell, I have a really horrible cold, so I don't always sound as bad.
You sound great.
But I'll do my best. This is from Alicia's diary, and she's talking about a painting that she's doing where she has attempted to paint Jesus on the cross, but she's found out that the picture hasn't been working for her throughout the book, and she's been struggling as to why, and this is when she sort of realizes why. Okay. I did have a bit of a breakthrough. I finally understood what's wrong with the Jesus picture, why it's not working. The problem isn't with the composition, Jesus on the cross. The problem is it's not a picture of Jesus at all. It doesn't even look like him, whatever he looked like, because it's not Jesus. It's Gabriel. Incredible, I didn't see that before. Somehow, without intending to, I've put Gabriel up there instead. It's his face I've painted, his body. Isn't that insane? So I must surrender to that and do what the painting demands of me. I know now that when I have an agenda for a picture, a predetermined idea of how it should turn out, it never works. It remains stillborn, lifeless. But if I'm really paying attention, really aware, I sometimes hear a whispering voice pointing me in the right direction. And if I give in to it, as an act of faith, it leads me somewhere unexpected, not where I intended, but somewhere intensely alive, glorious, and the result is independent of me, with a life force of its own. I suppose what scares me is giving into the unknown. I like to know where I'm going. That's why I always make so many sketches, trying to control the outcome. No wonder nothing comes to life, because I'm not really responding to what's going on in front of me. I need to open my eyes and look and be aware of life as it is happening and not simply how I want it to be. Now I know it's a portrait of Gabriel. I can go back to it. I can start again.
Perfect.
That's it.
Perfect. That was Alex Michaelides reading from The Silent Patient. So I assume that's an example of you sort of putting yourself and your own writing process and thoughts into Alicia's process. Which I guess gets us to how much of the novel you had conceived before you sat down to write it and how much you allowed the element of surprise to play into it and sort of when you had solved the question of the novel for yourself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's an interesting process. I mean, I think what changed me, you know, what I just read out there, I think is actually my philosophy for life as well as for writing. Because, I meditate a lot, and I became aware, the more I meditated, the more I was aware of my thoughts. And when I'm writing, I'm able, therefore, to hear little ideas that I desperately want to ignore. In fact, Charlie Kaufman said it in a lecture, and he said that when you hear the whispering voice telling you to dispose of 5 years' work that you don't want to listen to, that's the right voice to listen to.
Hmm.
And so I was able, I think, to be malleable and flexible during the writing of this. But on the other hand, it came to me very organically, the whole story, the main bare bones of the plot. And they didn't really change. What changed was, as I said, Alicia's voice. That was kind of left, you know, as a blank. I had no idea what was going to be in the diaries at all. And then that all came to me over that summer as I sort of, you know, tried to become her. And that was the scariest bit, because that was the bit that didn't have a, you know, an outline. I hadn't, you know, thought about it enough. And then that ended up changing other parts of the first outline that I'd made. So it was a backwards and forwards, you know, like a tapestry is kind of how I think about it sometimes.
Yeah, right. And it's organized a bit around a Greek play, no surprise, given that you grew up in Greece. And I was wondering if that... Go ahead. Do you want...
No, carry on.
I was just wondering if that created sort of an organizing principle for you, or a framework in which you could work in, if that was another structure laid over the top of this that gave you help, or if that, you know, sort of sprung organically up and just kind of mapped on in the right ways, but wasn't necessarily a structural framework for you to work from. Does that make sense?
Right. That's interesting. Weirdly, the myth is the oldest part of the book. And that's been with me my whole life, pretty much. So, you know, so growing up in Cyprus, you know, in the way that in England Shakespeare is performed and taught in schools, and, you know, in Greece you learn Homer and the Greek myths, and the Greek tragedies are constantly being, you know, performed and reconceived. And I came across this myth of Alcestis when I was about 13, and it's a play by Euripides about a woman who she dies to save her husband's life. And yet when she's brought back from life at the end of the play and reunited with her husband, she refuses to speak and she remains silent until the end of the play. And it's rarely performed because it's sort of unsatisfying or problematic and nobody really knows what to make of her silence. Hmm. And I probably came across that when I was 13 years old, and it just haunted me because I wanted to know the answer. That was when I sort of tried to update and modernize that story. That the silent patient was born. So it was very much, you know, a huge part of the process, yeah.
It's tricky because you want it to be in conversation, obviously, with the plot, but you also don't want it to overwhelm the plot, or you don't want it to be map on too precisely to make it feel, you know, contrived or something. And so I thought that was really a wonderful, delicate balance of keeping it kind of in the reader's subconscious, and, you know, you're certainly aware of it and aware of the reverberations, but it's not so obvious that it, you know, distracts you from the...
I think reverberation is a very good word, actually, because I do think that that's what the Greek myths do for us. You know, they're part of our universal unconscious. And so just by having it weave its way through the story, and then, of course, thematically it started, you know, affecting things and making me color things in different ways. It's almost like it speaks for itself and it reverberates in us as we read. I realized that the more I went into it, that there are numerous reasons as to why she might not speak. And so it's sort of it's about the refusal to, part of it's about the refusal to conclude, I think, which is what makes it a haunting play. And I was just trying to capture some of that in the book, you know, that feeling of a kind of, well, the producer who's going to make it into a movie said to me that what he really likes about it is a negative space. Mm. And that took me an awfully long time to understand what he meant. Mm. And I think he means the subtext. I think he means all the things that are unsaid and unspoken. Mm-hmm. And that was a very deliberate, conscious part of me as a writer, you know, towards the later drafts of the novel. I thought, okay, well, the theme here clearly is, you know, I'm a very basic person, so I just go back to something like On Writing by Stephen King, you know, where he says, read your draft and then look for the theme here and there, and then weave it all the way through. And so I did. I read it, and I saw the silences, and I thought, okay, well, this is a book about all the things that we don't say to each other, and all the characters are unable to communicate with each other on some level or refuse to. You know, and then it becomes kind of thematic, I suppose.
That's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. Yeah, and what a challenge, as I said before, to work with a narrator who doesn't speak. I suppose the diaries, even if they came towards the end, you must have known that that was going to be a texture of the novel, because how else can we get access to her if she's not going to talk to us?
Yes, but originally they were, you know, it's interesting you say that, again, from a, you know, writing perspective. Originally they were going to be in one central block, just in the middle of the book.
Oh,
because gosh. I had this idea that by giving her a voice too soon, we wouldn't be able to project onto her. She wouldn't be a blank canvas for all of our, you know, thoughts and projections and feelings. And And I also wanted it to be threatening. And I thought, if I give her voice too soon, she's going to be too accessible. So I wanted her to be this remote character. And then when I read it, the first time I read it, I nearly had a heart attack because I just went, this doesn't work. Oh, my God, this doesn't work. Because the voice came too late. And as a reader, I was like, who? What is this? Mm. Different story. This isn't the story I'm reading.
Mm.
So I then realized I had to go through earlier sections and set up the diary and put little splinters of the diary earlier. And that took me a very, very long time. And my New York editor, Ryan Doherty, was very helpful with that as well because he agreed. It's sort of about giving her a voice, but not too much of a voice. So it's not a surprise later on when the diary entries do come, you know.
Right.
But it's a tricky kind of thing.
I like what you said about her being a blank canvas on which we can project our own stuff upon, because that's, you know, yet another way that therapy reverberates throughout the novel is, you know, isn't that what therapists do? They just sit there and stare at you until you until you say something revealing.
Yeah, again, that was part of the silence. You know, I've had a lot of therapy myself, and I know that, you know, a lot of therapists will just let you, will just sit there and let you wait, or they will wait and wait and wait until you speak.
Right.
And if you don't speak, you don't speak. But I, you know, I have strong opinions about therapy, and I think that can be quite re-traumatizing for a lot of people. So I was fortunate that my therapist wouldn't do that. She would at least say hello or how are you,
right.
or something to help me kind of get going. You know.
Right. There's another wonderful therapist in the some of the minor characters in the book that we're too short on time to talk about. But that's wonderful. The other thing that lost my whole train of thought, but I wanted to talk about unreliable narrators. And to some extent, you know, without giving anything away about the novel, you know, the reader doesn't know who to trust. And I loved that you don't frustrate the reader. You know, the risk of that is that the reader gets frustrated. And you manage that very well, that you know, we kind of don't know what to believe halfway through or what to think. And and yet we're carried along and swept along and never get frustrated by what's happening. And I thought maybe you could talk for just a moment about dealing with unreliable narrators and if there are any rules that a writer must follow to keep the reader interested but not frustrated.
Gosh, that's a really tricky question. I mean,
yeah.
For me, I don't think so much in terms of unreliable narrators as more as unreliable points of view, generally the reader's point of view. So the way I think about it is, you know, like I'm obsessed with, as I said, Agatha Christie, but also Henry James. And in many ways, I don't think that they're that dissimilar in terms of the way they like to present a triangle from the wrong way up.
Hmm.
So it's a conjuring trick, you know. So right from the beginning of the novel, you're looking at everything the wrong way around. I love stuff like that, you know. Hmm. And if you can, you know, say Agatha Christie's Five Pigs is probably the most perfect example of that I've ever read. And right the last page or two, you suddenly devastate because you realize you've been seeing the whole story the wrong way around.
Hmm.
And I was very much trying to achieve that because that's her operating at her best. It's what, you know, he does in Portrait of a Lady or The Ambassadors as well. So it was more, I don't necessarily think it's helpful to think in terms of an unreliable narrator, someone who's trying to trick you. It's more an unreliable author.
Right.
A more accurate way of thinking about it.
I really love that idea of the unreliable reader. And you're right, that you look at it, you know, like one of those paintings that you look at it one way and then you shift and you look at, you know,
yeah.
It's a boat, now it's a... Now it's,
yeah,
a,
yes, totally.
Now it's a witch.
That was very much in my mind, yeah.
Yeah. And so when does that come about in the process? Is that all through revision that you then realize what it is and you go back to massage and massage to make it work?
Yeah, I knew right from the beginning what it would be.
Okay.
I was very fortunate with that. It is sort of, I was walking in the park one day and had some teeth and I just stopped. I went, oh, wow, yes, of course, that's the way it should go.
Okay.
But that happened right at the beginning. It was all pretty fully formed in my head. So I don't know. And then I did try to, yes, obviously you have to kind of tweak it here and there to make sure, you know, again, this is all basic stuff, but, you know, Billy Wilder, who says that everything that happens in the third act must be set up in the first act and vice versa. Everything that you've accidentally set up in the first act must be paid off in the third act or it must be cut. And that's why when I was a student at the AFI, I had a great teacher who said, just do a million outlines because it saves you time, ultimately. So I tend to outline a lot, like, obsessively. And I don't know, maybe 56 outlines of this before I started writing the novel. And it's that process of looking, going through it, checking the setups, making sure everything gets paid off, working backwards systematically. I don't know why I keep thinking of this image of tapestry, but it does feel a lot like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You have to keep weaving backwards and forwards the whole time.
Hmm. It's like Alicia's, all the sketches she made in the passage that you read, and then something surprising still emerges.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. One thing I've taken away from this is I need to take way more walks in the park, because it sounds like that's very true.
Well, you know that Dickens would walk every night for miles. And I do find it helpful to do, like, you know, physical activity, I think, does free your subconscious a lot.
I think so.
I think it was just like that kind of thing, you know. I'm sure you would find that.
Yeah, yeah. I think the more you sit and are stagnant at your desk and things aren't moving literally on the page and you're not moving literally and you're, you know, around, you're right. Get up and move around is a helpful.
One of the things that the psychiatrist used to say at the clinic I worked at to the kids was, move a muscle to change a thought. And it does work. If you get sitting in one position stuck in your thinking process, just move, and it helps free you up a bit.
I love that. I love that. You have so many great, you come up with so many great words of wisdom here. Are there more? Are there things you live by that we can live on? Yeah, if there are other things that have kind of sustained you. I mean, it really sounds like your screenwriting background, in terms of plotting and story organization, have been really helpful. I heard that there was a book that you had referenced, Cameron Crowe, Billy Wilder, something
right.
like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to look that up. I haven't delved into that. But is that sort of a...
Yeah.
Are there things useful in there for writers for kind of guiding principles?
Oh, yeah, totally. Everyone must read that. It's such a one, but also just how to live life, and the two are the same in many ways. You know, it's a wonderful book, and I really recommend it. I think where I struggle with is that I have yet so far to be able to, because yes, I took everything from my screenwriting background, all of the plot construction, 100%, but I was never able to kind of access any depth in my screenwriting. But with a novel, I was able to, and that's something haven't quite cracked in my head yet. It's a lot easier to access depth when you've got pages and pages and pages to write. But in a dramatic scene, I do find it's maybe I'm just a novelist and not a dramatist. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you're wonderful at both. So, you know, why choose? But
you're very kind. Thank you.
This was wonderful. Sadly, we're out of time, but let us know where we can. Can we stalk you online? Can we find you elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm Alex Michaelides.
Perfect. Perfect.
And the books are, you know, available, you know, Amazon and Barnes and Noble and all kinds of places.
The book is all over, and
it's been a real pleasure talking to you. But it's really nice to talk about the craft of writing. It's not something I often get a chance to do. So
yeah.
Enjoyed it.
It's fun for us too. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time. This was great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Alex Michaelides. The book, The Silent Patient, is out and available now, getting all sorts of acclaim. I actually listened to the audiobook myself, and that too is a great treat. I mean, it's incredibly immersive. So we're going to take a very short break. Amy Meyerson will join me for the second half. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are under Writers on Writing. If you subscribe to our podcast, you will get our regular updates, so you'll know when we've put new shows up. And we're on Facebook. You can find us on Writers on Writing. We also do our podcasts up there. So there is no way not to listen to us. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Amy Meyerson is a graduate of Wesleyan University and the University of Southern California. She lives in L.A. and teaches in the writing program at USC. Her debut novel is The Bookshop of Yesterdays, published by Park Row. It will drive our discussion this morning. Amy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So this, I love bookstores. I love independent bookstores, and I love books about bookstores. So this was an all-around...
My target audience.
Right? All-around treat. So for people who haven't yet picked up the book, I'm going to kind of let you set the stage for the bookshop of yesterday's and kind of take us into this world and introduce us to the characters, and that'll set us up for a chat.
Sure. The book is... The main character's name is Miranda. And when she was a little girl, her uncle was her favorite person in the world. He used to set up these elaborate scavenger hunts that taught her how the world worked. And then when she was 12 years old, she witnessed part of a terrible fight between him and her mother. And after that, she never saw him again. The book picks up 15 years later when Miranda is a middle school history teacher. And she receives a copy of The Tempest in the mail, which is the play that she's named after. And in it, she finds something that she thinks might be from her uncle contacting her. Soon thereafter, she discovers that he has passed away, and he has left her his bookstore in Los Angeles called Prospero Books, also from The Tempest. And so she goes to L.A. to figure out what to do with his bookstore, and when she gets there, she starts to find clues that her uncle has left her in books across the shelves that lead her on a journey, a scavenger hunt, kind of like the ones he used to plan for as a child, where she talks to people from her family's past and begins to uncover this secret family history of why they never saw him again.
such a great book. So take us into kind of what the point of entry was for you. Was it Miranda's character? Was it kind of this idea of scavenger hunts? Was it the bookstore? Kind of take us into what sparked your initial interest in writing it.
Sure. I, in general, start with ideas, and then the characters come later. So with this book, which was my first attempt at writing a novel, I knew even before I had an idea that I wanted to write a book that celebrated books that I love and that was really a celebration of reading for readers as well. So I had that sort of in the back of my head. And then years ago, I read this essay in the New York Times Book Review. It was called You Never Know What You'll Find in a Book. And it was all about the bizarre things that people have found in used books that other people have left behind, both intentionally and not. And so it detailed everything from a baby's tooth to a petrified piece of bacon to one bookseller found $40,000 in a used book. I think my favorite one anecdote was a landscape architect that used to sprinkle soil in his books so that when he opened them, they smelled like the earth. Mm. And I was just really struck by the idea that you can tell a lot about a person based on what they've left behind in their books. So that was really the origin. I tore the essay out of the newspaper and kept it in my journal probably for a year or two before I knew what I wanted to do with it. And I was sort of thinking about who might leave things in books intentionally and what kind of journey might that create, and that kind of led me to someone who runs a bookstore, and it sort of took off from there.
So tell me about those really first initial drafts where you sat down, the page is blank, you've got this article over here, and you're starting to mine these characters and you're starting to tease out the story. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what those very initial attempts looked like in comparison to could you have seen what was coming down the road? Was it pretty, you know, recognizable when you started out to what it became, or did it really take on a shape of its own through the course of revisions and drafts and all of that?
Yeah, not at all. I don't think that there might be two sentences from the first draft that ended up in the final draft.
Wow.
This book has really, really been a labor of love. I've written more drafts than I can count. I started it in graduate school. So I started about 8 years ago, and I always knew I wanted to write a novel, but I didn't really know how to write a novel. So there were a lot of false starts. I think that the first draft was much more character building and figuring out who the characters were than actual narrative. One thing that really helped me was I took a TV writing class at UCLA Extension just kind of for fun, and that was really where I learned plot, because even though I write novels. I haven't really explored television that much. In TV, you have to make decisions quickly. And so that was something that got me to think about the book a little bit differently. So once I sort of had that idea of focusing on plot, I used the books that where the clues are that kind of punctuate the story to help me come up with a rhythm and also a way of breaking the book into smaller chunks. One of the things I discovered pretty quickly about writing a novel is that it's massive and that you can't approach it like you approach a short story. So when I used to write more short stories, after I finished a draft, I would put them all on the floor, or all the pages on the floor, and look at it all at once. And you can do that when something is 15 pages or 20 pages, but when it's over 300 pages, my house isn't big enough. So I started to think about ways to break it up, and that was something that really, really helped me. But in a lot of ways, I think of this as both my first and second novel, because I've just, in a lot of my friends in the time that I wrote this, I've written two novels, and I just kept, I really believed in the idea, and I just kept going back and revising. So it's very unrecognizable. And when I was done, I was very tired.
So listeners, this is the takeaway from this morning, is to run out and take a screenwriting or a television writing class. So the first guest that was on this morning came from the screenwriting discipline and really talked about how all of those principles helped him in writing the novel he wrote. And I do think that for novelists who typically, a lot of novelists I talk to are very character-oriented, and you know what interests them is character mining and character development, and plot kind of takes a back seat. And so this is really helpful. I mean, it's helpful to, he was saying that every scene has to have a plot point in order to, you know, make the cut in the end. And if it doesn't, if it's not advancing the plot, it gets tossed out. I don't know if you found that. It felt like that in this book, that every scene had a purpose and had a plot, moved things forward. I don't know if that's something you took away from the television class.
Well, I do think from both, I have a lot of friends who are screenwriters as well, so from that class and from my friends who are screenwriters, I think of it more as conflict. That I remember that being the big thing, that every scene has to have conflict in it, which conflict drives plot. I think for me, one of the things that was especially helpful about taking a TV writing class was that, you know, I've taken a lot of creative writing workshops, and I think fiction writers in particular, we tend to, when we talk to each other, talk a lot about the craft and prose. And so you get a ton of lessons and attention on the words on the page, but plot doesn't usually come into that. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, I mean, I think plot is a challenge for a lot of people, but for me, I just started when I was writing this to think about, well, what pulls me into other books? And I really love a good story. That's, you know, even more than characters, that's what engages me. So it was what I was mindful of when I was writing this.
Yeah, and it felt like that. So you're talking to somebody who can't solve a Scooby-Doo mystery still. So, you know, anybody who can put together a scavenger hunt and a mystery and make it make sense is so, you know, I just bow down to that because I just can't do it. So let's talk a little bit about that and constructing. You know, as you say, these 300 pages and you're trying to construct a story, you're also trying to construct a mystery within the story. And I don't know if those kind of come about parallel and simultaneously with each other, or if you kind of worked out the mystery and the scavenger hunt clues independent and then sprinkled them throughout the story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I definitely figured out the scavenger hunt. That was sort of my way of outlining, was that I picked all of the books that are part of it, although those changed multiple times throughout the writing process, because every time I changed, basically the books that make up the scavenger hunt, I picked them very carefully. So the idea is that her uncle leaves a clue in the book, and that clue sends her to talk to someone from her family's past. But I wanted something about the book that the clue was in to resonate with the story that she was being told. So either the themes or the narrative of the novel in some way resonated. And then I also wanted to have a quote that I could pull from the book that her uncle would highlight for her that told her kind of how to read the story or how to interpret the story she was about to be told. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, I also wanted the books to be books that readers would know and hopefully love. So I had to pick them very carefully, and that really helped me outline the novel. And I definitely did that in advance. I wish that I had figured out the mystery of it earlier than I did. That was a lot of my revision was I had this big idea, and then it took me a while to decide what actually happened. So one of the biggest lessons I learned from this book that I'm employing in my new novel is there's another family secret at the heart of it, and I made sure I knew exactly what that was before I started writing.
Do you think that knowing, I always have this debate with writers about if the writer knows too much too early, they tend to tip their hand to the reader very subconsciously, but it's harder. Like, I just think the pleasure often comes when the writer also doesn't know what's going on and they discover it together, because then it's this very organic, like, oh my God, I never saw that coming.
Yeah, I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, though,
okay.
Because I want to know sort of the larger ideas of where it's going. But I definitely don't. I mean, that was one thing that I also took away from a TV writing class, is that in television and film, you have to outline extensively. And that didn't really work for me, because then by the time I actually wrote a script, I felt like I'd already written it before, and so it felt a little stale. So I definitely think within interactions between characters and how things unfold, for me anyway, I don't want to know that too much in advance, but I need to know where it's going, because what I realized in early drafts of this book is when I didn't know where it was going, I just slowed everything down so I didn't have to make decisions.
Right.
Which was helpful for character, for knowing my characters, but I think for me anyway, knowing the big picture is really helpful because it gives it a clear drive.
Yeah, right. So talk a little bit about your research. I'm coming to appreciate why it would take 8 years to write this, when you have to lay out all of these different novels and find the passages and figure out, you know, how the mystery of it unfolds. I imagine a tremendous amount of research went into that, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that process and discovering these books, discovering the passages, and what other research may have gone into it.
Sure. I love to research, and that was one thing that I learned writing this book. And I think it's probably not, which I would guess is a good thing, it's probably not apparent just how much research I did in this book. I mean, I did research in terms of, I didn't think of it as research, but I revisited a lot of books that I love. Mm-hmm. One of the things I did for every clue, I picked about 5 novels that I thought might work, and then I reread them. And I also tried to read some criticism about them as well, because I knew what I thought about it, but I was just curious how other experts were talking about it too. So I did a lot of research in that regard. I also, in earlier drafts, to my main character, Miranda, is a middle school history teacher, and one of the themes of the novel is the idea of personal history versus, national American history, and how we kind of divide the two. And I was really interested in the idea of a character who was very invested in our nation's history, but not so much in her own history. So in earlier drafts, there was a ton of American history, and I did a lot of research there. And sometimes it's worth it. It's definitely worth it that, you know, you research extensively and then all that ends up is one sentence. So I did research in that regard. And then her uncle, in addition to owning a bookstore, is a seismologist. So I did a lot of research about earthquakes and seismology and the sort of research and rescue that goes into that happens immediately after these huge earthquakes. And then there's a part that's about particle physics, so I researched that too. So I tried to, it was sort of all over the place. The research for this book definitely happened organically, in that I knew I wanted one of Billy's friends to be a physicist, so I started researching physics rather than the opposite, where I was already researching it and then used it for a character.
Yeah. Well, and all of those things are such wonderful metaphors for the book. I mean, obviously, as you're talking about the history and the family history and, you know, what happens in the past reverberates into the future, and the past is prologue and all of that. But, you know, the earthquakes are certainly also very metaphoric, and particle physics can also be metaphoric. And then I was wondering, maybe if you choose anything, you can kind of make it a metaphor, but these worked so beautifully. And I imagine that comes out of the writer's subconscious mind, and then you look back on the drafts and say, oh my God, that's just perfect.
Yeah, well, so I really wanted, and something, I mean, one of the things that's nice is that once you get your story down, then you can start to do more drafts that are focused on themes and the undertones of the book. And so once I kind of knew what happens, then I realized that I really wanted this to be a California novel, particularly an L.A. novel. And so in earlier drafts, Billy was always a scientist. For some reason, I just immediately knew that I wanted him to be. But I had him as a physicist in earlier drafts as well. And then I realized that part of what would make it a really good California book was to have him study earthquakes. And then after I came up with that idea, I realized that that worked really well because earthquakes in a lot of ways are like these fights, these estrangements where it's always just kind of sitting there and you know it's going to happen, that there's going to be a big one that changes things at some point. You just don't know when and you have no means of preparing for it.
Right, right. It's so good. My guest this morning is Amy Meyerson. The book is The Bookshop of Yesterdays. Let's talk a little bit about independent bookstores because I love to give them a shout out, and B, this was so immersively, you know, it's just like coming home to an old friend when you're mired in one of these old independent bookstores with kind of half used, half new books, and the cafe next door, and all of the wonderful stuff that goes on with used bookstores. And, you know, you made, so this bookstore is in a bit of a financial peril, and which is, you know, very real life, unfortunately. So it was, you know, I don't know how much time you spend hanging out in independent bookstores and the research for that, but all of that felt very authentic too and very, very LA.
Thanks. Yeah, I spent a bunch of time in bookstores. I mean, I even before this novel, whenever I traveled, I always made sure to go to bookstores. And I think most readers, or if I can say all readers, love bookstores. It's a, you know, it's a celebration of books and of the community that grows around novels. One thing I didn't know when I started this was that it was a sort of subgenre of fiction. It wasn't until, and I'm glad I didn't read any other bookshop novels. I think I'd read Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore before, early on while I was starting this. But otherwise, I hadn't really read any of those bookstore books, and I'm glad that I waited until after I was working on it. But it was, I understand, you know, I came to this idea because I love bookstores, and I figured that readers love bookstores too, and once I realized that it was a whole subgenre, that made sense to me. But so in the, I guess early on, how I started preparing for this was I just, you know, anytime I went somewhere, I went to a bookstore. I also wrote the early drafts of this in Stories Books and Cafe, which is in Echo Park. Mm. And I visibly, it resembles Prospero Books. People who go there told me they were like, yeah, it looks a lot like Stories. So while the store itself is the characters, and I think that store is doing very well, so the finances are different. That was where I took a lot of inspiration visibly. I also, when I would write there, I'd sort of be half writing and half kind of spying on other people who were there and the conversations. I overheard a lot of stuff. I also read a lot of bookseller blogs to, you know, find out how booksellers talked about their bookshops. And then once I sold the book and I knew it was going to be published, I realized I better talk to some people who worked in bookstores, because while I've had a lot of experience waiting tables, and I definitely borrowed some customer interactions from that, I hadn't worked in a bookstore before. So I contacted my other local bookstore, Skylight, where I go and have gone for readings all the time, and the manager was really wonderful. He invited me into the store and gave me a behind-the-scenes tour of everything, and then, you know, for months after, while I was working on the last couple of drafts, just answered all my random questions. And then since the book has been published, I've gotten to go to a lot of bookstores to do readings, and I've just been so impressed by all of the wonderful people who work in bookshops. And I was really heartened by the fact that, they all see each other as a community. So bookstores are not competitive with each other. They, what's good for one bookstore is good for all bookstores.
Right.
It helped make this experience that much more special to be able to then go and share it with booksellers.
Well, they must love you. I mean, they must love books like this because they're it's mutually beneficial situation. So it's that's very cool. It's very cool. We are drawing down on our time, but through the course of, I know you teach at SC, and this being your first novel, is there, and we've talked a lot about it, but is there other advice or things that have sustained you that got you through the eight dark years of writing, or you know, things that advice that you got along the way that really helped?
I think the three things that I have taken away from this are certainly perseverance. Mm. You have to be willing to persevere. I think the other part of that is not being precious. It's hard sometimes to hear criticism, but it's intended to make the book stronger. I think I was really lucky along the whole process that through the entire time I had people who believed in me. So that started with Judith Freeman, who's a novelist who was my thesis advisor, who saw something in this idea even before I did. And then when I was doing a couple drafts for my agent, right away, as soon as I sent it to her, even though she wanted a lot of changes, she believed in it. Same thing with my editor. So it made the process easier because I had support throughout. I think the biggest thing is, you know, one of the things I noticed is that this might seem obvious, but in order to publish, you have to finish. And I think that's the biggest challenge for most people is actually finishing, because finishing doesn't mean just writing a draft. It means going back again and again, and that can be really hard. One thing that really sustains me is every time I sit down to write, I like to read first. Mm-hmm. And so for me, one of the things that gets me motivated to write is when I read something that I love, or read something that's beautiful and find inspiring. So whenever I would get frustrated with the process, I would return to another book.
I love that. Where in the process did you get your agent and editor? Like, were you close to the end, or were you kind of in the middle?
In the middle. So I worked on my book, I would say, for about 5 years, which I think was too long. So another thing that I learned along the way, that friends don't always believe me when I say this, but I still tell them anyway, is that I think a lot of writers spend too much time before they, and sure, some writers don't spend enough time, but there's this desire to make everything perfect before you get an agent. And in my experience, the agent is looking for promise of an idea and promise of strength as a writer. So there nowadays, agents do a lot of revisions with writers before they send books out. So you have to be prepared to rework a lot. So I probably spent a year kind of copy editing my book before I got my agent, at least. And then very few of those pages are in the final draft.
Interesting.
So, so I definitely would recommend, you know, obviously you want it to be something that's polished and you're proud of, but don't labor over it such that you're fatigued by the time you find an agent.
Or wedded to it and not willing to change it.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
I found my agent. I was very fortunate at both stages. Once I decided it was ready, I found my agent pretty quickly. She believed in it right away. And the same thing happened with my editor as well. So where the hard parts were for me was just a ton of revising.
Right. Well, the fortunate part is that we get to talk again. So if folks have tickets to Literary Orange, Amy and I will be on a panel there in April. Tickets are hard to come by, so perhaps not. But are there other places we can find you and stalk you?
You mean social media?
Yeah, social media. Or if, I don't know if you're doing any... Well, you're probably not doing any more book tours. The paperback's probably coming out pretty soon, yeah?
Yes, the paperback is coming back in May. So I have my website, which is just amymeyerson.com, And I'm on Instagram as Amy Meyerson. I post a lot of book updates there. That's kind of the prime social media that I use. Okay. I'm doing another event in Irvine, which is a fundraiser, I think through Creating Conversations in May.
Cool.
But the paperback comes out at the beginning of May, and then I think I'm going to be doing a book tour on the East Coast.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. So we can find you. We'll follow that on Instagram and find you there.
Yeah, and I always post videos of my talks.
I love it. I love it. Amy Meyerson, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. That was Amy Meyerson. The book is The Bookshop of Yesterdays. Again, she and I will be in conversation at Literary Orange in April. That's all the time we have for today. I'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Actually, Barbara will. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day, and stay tuned for more jazz coming up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.